Hey, y'all. My name is Ann Wyatt. I started my career in workforce development with the state of Kentucky in 2010. That experience ignited a deep passion for manufacturing within me. I started this show hoping to raise more awareness around the bright outlook manufacturing careers have. Join me as I sit down with some of the manufacturing industry's most successful change makers and learn how they're partnering people with technology. It's time to give people more meaningful work. This is Workforce 4.0. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to another episode of Workforce 4.0. This is your host, Ann Wyatt. I'm super excited today because we have a very special guest with us. Philip from Dirac is here. He's going to talk all about manufacturing, the amazing movement that's going on with CAD, machining, other industries, and how we can take steps in preserving tribal knowledge for the manufacturing workforce. But Philip, welcome to the show, man. You want to tell everyone what you all are all about and what you're into?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's super exciting to be on. Hey, everybody. My name is Phil. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Dirac. We're building out some software that automatically generates assembly work instructions for manufacturing engineers. Been pretty excited building out the company. Get to meet a lot of very cool folks working on some really cool systems all over the country, all over the world. So I'm just grateful I get to do that. I'd love to tell you guys a little bit more about my background. So my background's originally in electrical engineering and robotics. I spent a little bit of time over at Northrop Grumman, got TS clearance, worked on some pretty cool radar stuff over there. When they ran out of electrical engineering work to give me, they gave me some mechanical engineering work to do. When they ran out of mechie work to give me, they gave me some technician work. So did a little bit of assembly, a little bit of test, just got to see how absurdly and unfortunately archaic a lot of the infrastructure was on the manufacturing side of things, of what to me seemed like a pretty advanced company on the engineering side of things. And I wanted to do something about it. So I got my best friend and now co-founder and CTO, Peter, and we set out to go build Dirac. We basically got the feeling that the West was forgetting how to build great things, and we wanted to make sure that it didn't. Tell you a little bit more about the company and how we got here. We are automating work instructions, but it's actually not first version. We initially set out to go build our own manufacturing facility. Trying to raise some venture money to do that. Not usually a great idea, to be honest. It's spent private equity is a little bit more geared towards funding factories and all that, but venture dollars, not the best way to do that, for sure. So we actually initially tried to go build this robotic aerospace manufacturing facility. So basically we bring more automation and mass production techniques to aerospace. And yeah, basically spent 6 months on the road talking to 90 aerospace manufacturers, trying to get them to outsource their assembly work to us. And I was going around telling him, hey, we're building out this factory of the future. It's going to be super cool. I didn't really know too much about how we were going to do it. But sure as heck, we were going to try to get them to outsource their assembly work to us. And I ended up hearing over and over again, the factory idea seems cool, but that software that we had under the hood that was taken in a CAD file, automatically figuring out how to do all the assembly, that would actually be game changing for the guys on the shop floor today. Could they just have the software? And I was super stubborn, right? I'm a hardware guy. I was like, software's lame. We're not a software company. We're a hardware company. We're building this factory. But you kept hearing the same thing over and over again for 6 months and eventually caved. I said, okay, fine. You know, maybe the software is a better place to start. And so we took that software, that internal assembly physics simulation software, we tore it out and we built a platform around it. And that is actually what Build the West is today. It's what we like to call the first automated work instruction. So sorry for the long intro there, but that's the high level. That's who I am. That's what we are. It's how we got here. So it's been a fun ride.
That's really awesome. That's really cool that you went out and tried to do that, and you're still doing that. Yes, currently.
Yes. Yeah. We are actively deploying our software to some really exciting manufacturing facilities, tier 1 through 3 suppliers, OEMs, folks who are in aerospace and defense, automotive, heavy industrial, so like agriculture and construction manufacturers. Really exciting companies. You know, get to see folks all over the country and to visit some really cool facilities.
That's awesome. And I gotta say, Phil, not only am I grateful to you for coming on the show and joining us today, but your background is a killer view, and that's from the new office.
Yes, we just moved into this new office a couple weeks ago. We are now in the Empire State Building, which is super, super exciting for us. This is an iconic building, right? This building represents what America was built on. Sweat, grit, and the desire to build great things. And so for us, every time we bring somebody new onto the team, like this is a what this building represents to me is something that I want to imbue into our company, into our culture. And it's really cool. On the first floor of the Empire State Building, there's like corridors with photos of the construction of the building. And whenever I take folks, whenever we have somebody visit the office, I always take them on that tour because I want them to understand this is what American greatness is capable of. This is what our culture, this is what our lives are founded on. It's like this ability and desire to go out and build something great. And so it means a lot to me that I get to build this company in this really cool new office. So yes, that is the this is like the view out outside of the back. It's very cool. If I actually
pull
the camera behind me, you can see that is the Hudson River. That's like Hudson Yards. Very cool. Sorry if my camera's shaking a little bit there, but that's also New Jersey. As a native New Yorker, always keeping an eye on those New Jerseyers. A little bit of the feud we have going on. Got to keep an eye on. Make sure they're not doing anything fishy.
That's so cool. That's so awesome and fun. And I love that story. And I love that the Empire State Building, that location means so much to you because of the concept behind peak American greatness and industrialism. That's awesome. Phil, I've got to welcome you in true Workforce 4.0 fashion. And you know, I got to kick this conversation off by asking you the very important question. It's very important, but I got to know, what's your go-to karaoke song?
Ooh, great question. I'm an avid karaokeer. It's actually one of the core things that our company does is like once a month, we'll get Korean barbecue and then we'll do karaoke as a whole team outing. I'm a pretty big karaokeer, I guess, to that effect. So my main karaoke song, go-to every time, is Careless Whisper. So I will belt it at the top of my lungs. It is a killer song. It's George Michael. It's a classic. When you hear it come on the radio, it's always that song. That's my song. It's my go-to. The obligatory. And I'll wait in a queue for 2 hours until that song comes on. And everybody knows, like, it's coming at some point, and I'm going to be ripping.
That's amazing. I love that so much.
Yeah.
You want to hum? You want to hum a few bars for us?
Oh, no, not on the air.
I completely understand some other time because I've got to catch that for sure. Yes.
This is it has to happen usually after 7 or 8 p.m. The Careless Whisper high and low notes can't just bring them out on a podcast.
I completely understand. I completely understand. Very cool. And I know you told us a little bit more about your founder's story here in the beginning and why you started Dirac, but is there anything that you wanted to add to that inspiration, maybe from your own personal perspective, just your goals, your vision for the future of work? What do you think?
So unfortunately, what we're seeing right now is a turning over of the mantle of American manufacturing production to a new generation that doesn't seem like quite ready to take the mantle. For me, it's generally like disappointing. You see a lot of really cool manufacturing facilities that have operated for, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, where a lot of really skilled, really talented manufacturers have been building some really complicated stuff. And the next generation doesn't seem to, or hasn't seemed to want to take on it. For me, what Dirac is all about is not only getting folks excited about taking on that mantle, it's about equipping them and radically improving quality of life for the folks on the shop floor actually doing the work. So that's a big thing for me. That's what, you know, inspired me to go all in on the company. It's understanding that the West was founded upon its capacity to build, right? And if we don't do that, if we can't produce well and at scale, our way of life is imminently threatened, right? Everything that matters to us, not only our values in our country, but the things that make us, the things that we derive our value from, it's all rooted in our capacity to build. And I think if we don't hold on to that and improve it and upgrade it to maybe the 21st century upgraded version of it, we're going to lose a lot of what makes America great. And I love America. I love what we stand for. And I want to make sure that we can continue to be the global dominant power and, you know, way of life. So that's the broader horizon. For Dirac as a company, I think we stand at a really interesting intersection where we're not only automating like a good chunk of the grunt work of making a work instruction, we end up serving as this really interesting, basically, platform where any work instruction that's being generated within our platform ends up being able to contextualize tribal knowledge within the context of this mechanical design. You have CAD software out there that's been being pushed for the past, you know, 15, 20 years, and everybody uses CAD. You know, not everybody, but a lot of people use CAD. But yeah, for folks, like, work instructions today, for 99.9% of people, are photos or like hundreds of screenshots that they'll take and then throw that into a several hundred page PowerPoint over time. And it's ridiculously tough to keep up to date. Nobody wants to. Half the time when you have some design revisions on the CAD side, they never actually make it to the work instruction. Those become grossly out of date. It's like you're four or five revisions behind. And so what we see the ability to do is not just help folks who are pushing towards like this model-based engineering side on the design side. We think that we have the ability to close the gap on the other side and push this new paradigm of like model-based manufacturing.
Yeah.
Not only to keep things going a lot faster and not only to tighten the feedback loop between design teams and build teams, but to make sure that whenever you have a new system going into production, it has context. That's our whole thing. Like, context is king. And a CAD file, you're not going to, it's actually really cool. There's a poster that I saw that this company Anduril put out. And you can't win, you're not going to win with blueprints, right? You, like a digital design, a CAD file will not save us, right? It is not a production system, right? It lacks an enormous amount of context and tribal knowledge in order to figure out how do we actually build this thing. It's really just this like platonic ideal of a thing, right? It's just this like digital virtual model. And that's cool. It's really nice. You can iterate on design a lot faster, but it doesn't actually help you manufacture faster. And so that's what we want to help do.
Not only that, yeah, you think about all the time it takes to update everything, right? And that's like a lot of time that you could be spending doing something to be more efficient, more effective in your manufacturing process.
Exactly. And you end up having folks like having to decide, do I want to keep documentation up to date or do I want to build something?
Do I want to get product out the door?
Exactly. Like, it's, you end up having to do that trade-off of, do I want to spend my time updating this Word doc or this PDF or figuring out, okay, is this thing even still assemblable? Like, how can I tell from the drawings? Do you want to spend your time doing that or do you want to spend your time putting product out the door? So that's what we want to help with. We want to help folks get back to building, not getting lost in PowerPoints and Word docs. So that's a lot of what we're all about.
I love that so much. And yeah, if you really do think about the incoming generations, including mine, I'm not sure what generation you fall under. I'm a millennial.
So. I'm somewhere between Gen Z and millennial. I'm a little more so on the, maybe I'm Gen Z. I don't know. I'm definitely on the younger side, but I would say I've seen a lot of, I think like boomers and Gen Xers are still they're like a dominant workforce in manufacturing. It's like the average age of manufacturers is like 55. Millennials are just dropping the ball. They're really dropping the torch. Not to the dog on your generation, but it's truly disappointing. It's like they got, it's post 1991, like, you know, fall of the Berlin Wall, fall of the Soviet Union. We thought like the West and democracy is global now and we won. And that was the last war we ever had to fight. So we could just like offshore all of our production and we would be totally fine. Like
NAFTA.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. we thought like we could be this like global, like hegemonic empire where we could do like the like economic equivalent of colonialism and take China and Japan and Korea and make them our like manufacturing vassal states. And so you guys are going to take all our production. We're just going to be this like tertiary economy and service economy. And we thought that would be great. Unfortunately, turns out that was not the end of history. And I think that was like some Kool-Aid that like the millennials drank. That's like the environment that they were like brought up in. And I think it is, millennials might not be totally lost, but I think it's critical for us to get Gen Zers and Gen Alpha like really excited about manufacturing, which I do think there are a lot of really cool folks out there who are doing a really great job to start doing this. But I think that's pretty critical.
I agree with you. I think that we've really got to start getting the younger generations back into the workforce. And I think I also agree with your point on technology. And I really think that's where we drop the ball as well, is we think about manufacturing as outdated. And we think about manufacturing as dark, undesirable jobs. But with technology, and if we really utilize the technology, then we could drive the industry as a whole forward. And yep. I think that's, we're at that intersection. And despite, I think, a lot of pushback, we're still that I don't see any other option. But Phil, I'd like to know from your point of view, when it comes to technology, how do you feel like that's going to influence the way that we work? And what role does technology ultimately play?
It's actually pretty interesting. Like I very much dislike when people try to push this narrative that technology is going to totally replace people. I don't think that's good. I don't think that's healthy, nor is it desirable. I think the goal of technology for the future of our workforce is to augment, like very much 80-20 rule type of stuff, right? That's how we talk about our software. We talk about it as an 80-20 tool. We want to automate 80% of all the grunt work, all the undesirable stuff that you really don't enjoy working on. And that 20%, that's intellectually stimulating, that's interesting. And for us, that's like where a lot of the tribal knowledge is. We want to radically improve the ability of somebody who's doing that task to do it. So I think the goal of technology in the future of our workforce is generally to augment and get folks 10,000 times faster to done, but still have a human in the loop. Like I don't think the approach that like, there's all these folks working on LLM chatbot stuff and like all the new AI stuff. It's like they really love to push the narrative that like we're gonna automate all like work. It's really funny because the most ironic thing is for 10, 15 years, you had all these AI philosophers talking about how, whoa, like the first things that are going to go are like manufacturing jobs, but are like the physical jobs. Like we're going to have like robots that like fold our laundry or whatever. But ironically,
I wish.
Yeah, it'd be nice. Dexterous tasks are like very difficult, but very funny. What they're actually starting to see with all like the AI chatbot LLM stuff is the first jobs that they think are going to be going are like the white collar ones, like lawyer stuff, like accountant stuff. And I think it's a little funny, it's a little ironic, but I also think that a lot of those people are also pushing like a narrative that like all labor is going to go out the door and, you know, we're going to completely automate all of labor. I'm like, that's nonsense. What are you talking about? I think what we're going to end up seeing is we're going to automate different tasks, right? Different like workflows are going to get streamlined. You're going to have this system talk to that system a lot better. Where there are a lot of jobs right now there are a lot of administrative jobs who's like where their job is to take paper in one folder and put it in another folder. And yeah, I think like those jobs, I think will get automated a little bit more. But when you have to do critical decision-making, when you're on a shop floor, there's a lot of trust. And I say this like over and over again, you can't automate trust, right? When you're on the shop floor, you trust the people around you, you trust the systems, and people who are procuring from you trust you. They trust your quality. And if you don't have that trust, it really erodes a lot of not only value, but like ways that people like relate to one another. And so there's I guess the best way to think about it is you're not going to see tools, I think, in manufacturing and production that like even try to 100% automate because they shouldn't. That would be a bad idea. Because if something comes in and it's, oh, I'm going to try to automate your job 100%, no one's going to adopt that, right? No one at a manufacturing facility is going to say, yeah, cool, I'll just let the machine do all the thinking. No, like you're going to need a final check. You're going to need somebody in the loop on something. But I do think that a lot of technology is going to go similarly to, you know how there used to be somebody like an elevator who would press the button for you, or they would like, you know,
I think
a lot of it's going to go like that. Just like fewer people involved, but not completely gone. And I think that's probably better. Like we'll be able to fewer people will be able to do more a lot faster and a lot better. And more people, like one person will be able to do a lot more. And I think that's like the philosophy that technology should do. Like the goal of technology isn't to replace people. It's to augment people and allow them to do more faster, better, stronger. And so the thing that will benefit a lot from that, or the industry that will benefit a lot from that, I think will be alongside a bunch of other things. But anyway, my soapbox on that.
No, for sure. And I don't disagree with you. I use ChatGPT and I use AI tools.
Yep.
I am not concerned at all at this rate on an AI tool being able to take my job.
Yeah. You know,
that thought is just not one time crossed my mind. I'm just, I guess maybe I'm just a little bit unimpressed. Did I say that? A little bit. And I think that ideology is really unrealistic. But I think for the things that you're saying, when you're looking at a lot of this administrative stuff, that, well, let's be frank, the person that is moving that file from another file, that's not their whole identity of their job in the first place. Like, why not give them a tool to do that for them so they can get back to the actual work of making the calls that they need to make, talking to the customers that they need to talk to, of leading the meetings that they need to lead.
Yeah, exactly. And I know you're in recruiting, right? So I don't think AI will replace recruiting at all, because one of the main, like the fundamental core of recruiting is you are bringing people together. You're getting deep at what makes somebody tick. Who are they? What matters to them? That is fundamentally a personable interaction. And the coldness of imagining that like you're that like level of intimate with a machine is just weird. And like nobody wants to be interviewed by a computer. Nobody wants to trust a computer to select candidates for them or to make that final decision. Maybe a recommendation machine to give you like 50 people who match a certain like high level profile, but you're never going to get, it's never going to close the thing fully.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. And I love that you keep going back to that trust aspect, and manufacturing trust is a very big deal. Obviously, when you're on a plant floor, especially with large equipment and large machinery, you have to have a lot of trust in the machinery, the equipment, and each other in your team. So just from a safety perspective. So I think that's really interesting. But when you're looking at from a four level perspective, and you're looking at some of the positions that maybe we should automate or implement technology for, what do you think, where are some starting points for that? What do you think could be automated and what maybe could not be?
That's a good question. I think that at least from where I sit, there are a bunch of different roles that connect different like pieces of process. You get an order in, right? You need to quote, right? I think quoting is probably a place that like could use a little bit more automation, because it's like low, it's the action or the task of generating a quote, it's not super fun or interesting or desirable. Nobody likes doing that.
And it's time consuming.
It's time consuming, and it like doesn't inherently generate a lot of value. It blocks value generation because it keeps you from getting more like more orders in the door. I think places that are ripe for automation, just from like a what should be automated, are things that don't generate value, but they block the creation of value. And so the whole goal, I think, generally speaking, should be the reduction of friction as much as humanly possible. And that to go from quote to production to out the door, anything that like stands between these different phases should have different like aspects of it automated, so that you can just go from like order in the door to order out the door as fast as possible. So but I think like the act of like when you're in the process of various aspects of production, I think we've actually gotten like pretty good at like different like tasks within production. Like we do have really fancy machines that do a lot of really interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
I think like we had that industrial revolution. I think we'll continue to make really exciting, interesting, useful machines. But I think the places that like today people will try to automate more
and should try to automate more are like the friction points between value driving and value creation, across different processes.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it from a macro perspective and really just looking at your own unique process as well and thinking about, okay, what's my process look like and what's going to be beneficial?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So a part of that, though, is being able to capture the tribal knowledge, I think, because you're still going to have the people on the floor and you're still going to need that certain skill set. Even if you do automate some of your processes.
Yeah.
And that I think is something that we haven't always done really well. Mm-hmm. But in what ways do you see us winning as an industry in improving on that or some ways that we are doing well with that?
So it's unfortunate. I don't know if we are seeing it being done well right now. We go into facilities pretty frequently and see that and hear like horror stories of, hey, we had this line up and we had basically the way that we were telling our operators to put something together, they were basically just getting like a 2D drawing and they had it printed out on paper. And maybe there were some post-it notes here or there, but a lot of it was just in the heads of the guys who've been on the shop floor for 25 years. And oh no, like with COVID, a bunch of these folks ended up retiring. And so now some of these lines are no longer operational. They can't make that thing anymore. I had a conversation with folks at a facility that they make like transformers. This was like one of the things that they made. And there was a system that there was one guy who knew how to make it, and he knew like intimately how to get some of their machines to do something that they like didn't quite know. Like this guy basically was the operator manual for this machine.
Sure.
And you know,
I know some folks like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we're not really doing a great job. This goes back a little bit to the point that we were making about how millennials are dropping the ball a little bit. Like they were supposed to inherit like the mantle of being trained up by that generation of Gen Xers and boomers who know how their shop floor operates intimately, and they never really wrote it down. And so I think one of the biggest problems is that passing of the torch and that baton and that training up. Part of it is, and this might get me in a little bit of trouble to say, but like part of it is a little bit of arrogance on the part of some of these really senior folks at these facilities. And sometimes they don't want to teach the new young folks who just got hired how to do a thing. Sometimes they are just too busy. And so that's a really tough problem that we see a lot of folks running into. It's like you have somebody who has done the same thing for 25 years and they're really good at it. But when it comes time to train somebody up, they might just like not have the pathway to do that. There might not be like a good process or system in place to pass on any tribal knowledge. They might not have any mentorship guidance. Like, how do I mentor somebody? Right? Like,
I hear
like
that a lot.
It's cool. Like, I know all these things. How do I, as somebody who knows all these things, has all this tribal knowledge, how do I teach someone this properly? Like, how do I train someone else up? Because it's one thing to learn a lot throughout your whole career and know how to do a process really well. Like, it's just muscle memory for you at this point. But it's a totally different skill set for somebody to teach somebody else. And it's frustrating because you're like, why? It's so easy for me. Why don't you get it? And then people let that frustration basically stand in the way of training somebody else up because there might not be because there are so many smaller, like mid-sized manufacturing facilities that have so much like very complex tribal knowledge. They, you know, folks at these facilities might not have the resources or the time to like really learn how to do that effectively. Like we used to have guilds, right? Guilds specialized in training people up. Right.
Yes.
Guilds did a really good job of making sure that tribal knowledge was passed down. But I don't really think we have guilds as much anymore. And like, certainly not in the way that we used to. Guilds in many cases, unfortunately, were replaced with like labor unions. And those labor unions are incentivized structurally to preserve what is there today, and rather than pass on that power and that, because like knowledge is power, right? If I'm the only person who knows how to do something, labor unions leverage that as they leverage that in negotiations to say, if you don't comply with what we're asking for, like these very skilled people are not going to do that anymore.
That's correct.
Like diminishes leverage when you train more people up because it's not as rare of a skill set if that's the case. So like incentives need to be aligned more so that there is an incentive to pass on tribal knowledge. So that's I think might get a little bit in trouble for saying that, but I don't think people talk about that enough.
No, I don't think we talk about that enough. And I think I definitely see the advantage and the point of view supporting labor unions.
Yeah,
but the other side of that, it is, that's, you're right. So we did used to have the guilds and that kind of took that capacity over, but they're not, it wasn't a parallel replacement.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe that's really what we need is a parallel replacement.
That would be, I think, really great, honestly. If like labor unions had an explicit function within them that did specialize in or did intentionally try to preserve tribal knowledge, that would be game changing. Right. I don't think you see this as much in the US. I think it happens a little bit in Europe. Germany has like a really interesting way that they train up their skilled labor. Very cool. Like, I just don't know if it's because of the way our economy works, we're like a lot more competitive and like government has like less of a hand in which like is good for a bunch of reasons. But I guess because we don't fund technical training as much as we should, right? The government does not, we don't have as many as we should federal and state incentives for training folks up in skilled trades, which like I think is a tragedy.
Yeah.
But also it's not cool, it's not sexy. Like for basically since the 90s, everybody was made to believe that like being in skilled trades was like dumb or bad or blue collar was bad.
Yeah. If you were the problem child, you could go to you could go learn skilled trades or something was how, in all seriousness, that's how I remember that perception being.
Yep. And like it's still going on today. It's also like ironic because you're like raised in this household in the suburbs or something. And you're told like, oh, if you don't study, you'll have to be a plumber. Like there's a couple of different pieces of that are like messed up. Have to be.
Plumbers make so much money.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, it's so funny. So I'm from Long Island originally. I'm from this town called Oceanside. It's on the south shore of Long Island. Like half the, like most of the kids I grew up with, like still in Long Island, a lot, like half of my friends I grew up with are like plumbers and the other half are electricians. And like very rarely did somebody end up like going to a good school or being in like an engineer. That was like relatively rare. And like software engineering jobs are like very rare. Like where I came, it's just not like nobody really knew about it. Like I didn't really know what an engineer was like as an occupation until probably maybe I was like 14 or something. I like heard about it. Just I like when I was like a little kid, when I was like 7, I wanted to be like an inventor. I like saw
Meet the Robinsons. Do you remember that Disney movie? Yeah, Meet the Robinsons. Yeah.
I saw, like, I knew about three things. I saw, like, Iron Man, and I was like, Tony Stark, like, that dude's an inventor. That's awesome. I had this, like, really thick book of, like, Marvel characters. Like, it's like a biography of this whole expanded universe. And it was really cool. Like, I got this book when I was 7.
That is cool.
And there was I flipped to the page for Tony Stark after seeing Iron Man 1, like, the movie just came out, it was, like, 2007. Saw his biography page. There's two things that I noticed. Like, one, he was born in Long Island, New York. And I was like, whoa, that's so cool.
That is cool.
Super cool. And I was like, haha, that could be me. That's so cool. And then the second thing is he got he had a degree in electrical engineering from MIT. I was like, ooh, that seems like a cool thing. I didn't know that was like a, so I had that in the back of my head. Oh, an electrical engineer. Wonder what that is. Neat. But yeah, if you're from like California, a lot of people know what software engineers are. And then I guess like, nowadays, more and more people do, but the ironic thing is, like, a lot of the folks who I grew up with, like, went on to have their own, like, practices, like, they're a plumber, an electrician, and they're doing really well, and they're not taking on, they didn't take on a ton of debt because they didn't go to some fancy, like a 4-year degree program from like some local university that was like a ridiculous amount of money, but like didn't like prepare them for the workforce. And it like didn't like, you know, it didn't make them, it's like you go and you get like a degree in like communications or something. And it's, you pay $90,000 a year for this degree at this school. It's
or like public administration.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just like these made up things, right? Like these made up jobs that like, again, this potentially get me in trouble, but.
I feel so seen, but I agree. So go on.
40, 50 years of bureaucrats like making up jobs and titles and names for things. It's like, what is a master's in public administration? What does that mean? What are you talking about? Wake up. These are made up words. You don't need a piece of paper from a bureaucrat in some ivory tower to tell you that you can accurately communicate with some other bureaucrat, some other ivory tower. It's just nonsense.
Or go into bureaucracy itself.
Yes. Yes.
I.e. government.
Yes. Literally. Literally. It's these people don't learn anything useful. It's like a degree in political science is not, just read a book. What are you talking about? Degree in somebody telling you how to, what books to read? Dude, the internet is free. You can look up great lists of books to read. I don't know. Anyway, it's my soapbox on this made up job.
But you Phil, that's what they told, that's what they told me to do.
Hey, your guidance counselor should have been fired. Guidance counselor also made up job generally.
Kind of. Well,
actually, I think guidance counselors, they get a lot of flack. I think that if people taught guidance counselors how to, again, like they didn't
coach.
Guidance counselor, they didn't used coach. To have guidance counselors. They have a guild master. He stood at the corner of a street and he recruited kids off the street.
Yeah.
And, like, you're coming to work with me now. You know, it's used to have proper adults in charge, right? We used to have like people who cared about how their society ran and operated. And like for like 30 years, those adults have been gone, right?
I absolutely agree with you.
Like the people who keep the, like a lot of people in Silicon Valley and like the who work in like tech or like some blue collar, some white collar jobs who don't know how things are built in the real world, who've never been on a construction site, who never been to a power plant, like, They just think that the lights stay on and they live in like this. I always talk about this in this context. It's, you ever hear of Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
Yes. Like,
very much. We, after the 90s, like we are just a huge chunk of our society started to live in like this higher tier of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And they like stopped realizing
they forgot that it's a pyramid and thought that it was a standalone platform.
Yes. And so that's what's happened over the past like 20, 30 years. The base of that pyramid, which is the people who hold up our society, who make sure the lights stay on and make sure that milk gets delivered to a nice, you know, refrigerator in a supermarket. Like those people are not only taken for granted, they're not being produced on a conveyor belt somewhere. Those are people. If you don't incentivize them, if you don't care about them, love them, and make sure that they are like taken into account, like your society is going to collapse. That's we're dangerously close to that if we don't actually start to incentivize people not only to go into critical jobs but stop like stigmatizing against them too. I don't know, it's a whole big cultural, you know, mess, but
it is a whole cultural thing. And I'm not saying that there's one easy, this is an easy solution by any means. It is a complex solution. There are things that I will note as a mother that I see with the educational, the way that the educational institution is structured, that do not favor anyone working in manufacturing. Now, whether that be the parents of small children or the incoming generation of the workforce, but that's something that I think is a very stark contrast in maybe other countries where they are a little bit more supportive of manufacturing.
Yeah.
As an industry, for sure.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily saying like child labor laws should be rolled back, but like kids should be way more exposed to like manufacturing jobs.
I agree.
We should be sending kids on field trips, not just to the aquarium and the zoo. Should be sending them on a field trip to a manufacturing facility. Get them a hard hat. Show them how stuff is made. Show them how they make paper. You know what I mean? It's just like, the stuff is super cool. Like growing up, there was this TV show called How It's Made.
Yes.
And what? It's like that show and then Mike Rowe's Dirty Jobs. Like,
oh, yes.
We need to nationalize those things or just like blast them way more. It's like we used to have for a brief period of time, for like 5-10 years, we had some really great like American manufacturing propaganda. We need to bring that stuff back because from like 2008 to like literally right now, we just stopped producing really cool content, really cool systems are made, right? And kids are fundamentally curious. Like they wonder like, why is the sky blue? How do you make paper?
Yes.
What is a pencil, right? Like stuff that they want to know, but like the parents that raise them have no idea.
I have answered literally two of those three questions this week. They either ignore the question, oh, like you're just a kid or whatever, or they don't know. And then they'll just say, I don't know. Now I am like very much of an advocate of, I don't know, but we should Google and find out.
Yep. Absolutely.
And I've had to do that.
Well, wouldn't it be cool if just because we incentivized it culturally, all parents just knew crazy, cool, esoteric facts about why does that car's wheel have that many spokes? Is that just a design? Is that a structural decision? You know, what stuff like that. I don't know.
Yes. No, like, I'm with you.
Yeah. It's like, what if our parents could answer those crazy esoteric questions that we had about why that thing, you know, why that thing looks like that and why it is like that? It's just like, it's seen as like low class to know how things are made. It's seen as like more, I don't know, it which is lame because knowing how things are made is really useful and helps
cool.
make decisions in your life in a lot better of a way. When you rely on like systems and like governments to tell you things without knowing why that thing is, you'll end up being really easily manipulated. And you'll because you don't have that knowledge base yourself, people will just be like, you won't know why things are happening to you, or you won't know why the world is working in a certain way. And people will tell you things and you'll have no choice but to believe them because you don't know. And I think the sooner we can get back towards people having a lot more knowledge around how the world works and how things fit together, how the world operates, the better we start getting as a society passing on tribal knowledge, the better we're going to be, because tribal knowledge compounds. If you break that chain, your society starts to collapse. I don't know. I care about that. I care about our society continuing.
I agree 100%. And with that, if you think about all of those symptoms and all of those things that we were talking about just there, maybe someone else is also as passionate as we are listening today, because you should be, because it is important. What are some actionable steps that you would give them to get started in closing that skill gap? So maybe three actionable steps that they can say, okay, today, you know what? Phil is right. We're going to go out. We're going to change the world, because they should be. I'm trying to. For you, what are those three steps?
I think off the top of my head, I would say the first thing you can do is make a conscious effort to have folks who have been around, been on the shop floor for 15, 20, 25 years, have them write stuff down. You get so caught up in the day-to-day of just trying to get parts out the door, you don't end up standing up like a program or having an initiative or intentionally saying, hey, when I make that thing, I'm going to write this thing down. I'm going to write down this little idea or suggestion that I would make to somebody. Like, I would say having, if you're a proprietor of a business, if you run a manufacturing facility, or if you yourself are a manufacturing engineer or an operator, make a conscious effort to write more stuff down as much as you can. And I hear about companies that do have these efforts that are consciously trying to write stuff down, but they're looking for the best way to do it. And that kind of leads me to probably what's like a good second point is adopt our software. I know software is super scary. There have been for the past like 10, 15 years, a lot of really big software companies that have sold a lot of kind of general garbage to a lot of really good people. And so manufacturers are very averse to adopting new software because they've been sold stuff that sucks and it never gets updated. And they're like held prisoner to this like software that really is not helpful to them. And they've grown to like mistrust software, which totally understandable, but I urge people to give it a try, like, get, you know, start to adopt a little bit more advanced stuff, just because for the main reason of there are a lot of the software that folks adopted like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even 5 years ago, it all, for the most part, was on-prem software. Like, it's a, you would get a file and you would download it, but you would get like a CD or something, you would download it. And that software takes a long time to update and iterate on and replace it. It's like you end up getting software 10 years ago and it takes you 4 or 5 years to update it. So you don't get to iterate as fast on that software. We are now in like a new age of software that people don't really think too much about, but we are now in a new age of software that is cloud-based. And that's just not, it's not just cool because, oh, I can access this software from like a web browser or anywhere. It's cool because you give feedback to that company and they iterate. Like, they can update that software automatically. Like, you don't have to update like once a year. Like, CAD software, unfortunately, most CAD software is from 20 years ago. And the newest version comes 1 year later, if you're lucky.
Yep.
But you might update your CAD software once every 4, 5, 6 years, just because it's no longer compatible with your version of Windows. Like, you go from Windows 10 to Windows 11 over, you know, 5, 10 years, or maybe you're still on Windows XP or something. That's when you update because you have to. But the whole cool thing about like cloud-based software now is you don't have to worry about updating it. The updates just get pushed to you. The software gets better. It iterates. And if you can have a relationship with that software company, this is why I love what I do. I get to spend time with folks that I'm building. So if you have a suggestion about how this can be better, you just let the software company know and they will iterate on it. They will take that into account. That's not something that software companies that have been around for like 20 years can really do or often really do. A lot of the newer ones like us, like, we can do that. And we do try to do that as frequently as possible. We work really well hand in hand with our customers to make sure that what we're building is useful and looks like and feels really smooth. And so I urge folks to give some more software a try, even though they might be hesitant because typically the software they've been being pushed on sucks. And a lot of the folks who wrote that software have never been to a manufacturing facility and don't really care about those guys. I urge you to try to work with software companies that seem like they care because the people who run them come from that background that understand your problem. Like us, as an example.
Don't hold on to that old bias, right? Yeah. With a new person or new connection. Yeah.
And then I would also say there's one or two more suggestions about what you could do today to start closing the skill gap. Another one is investing in like workforce upskilling. There's this thing that our team calls like bus factor. So bus factor is it's a number of how many people would have to get hit by a bus for your company to shut down. Meaning, like, if the bus factor of something is one, that means if that one person got hit by a bus, you cannot do the thing that is critical to your facility operating anymore. And so your company just out of business, done. So for a lot of manufacturing facilities, that is unfortunately like the bus factor on how they make their secret sauce or some really critical tribal knowledge is one. There's one person at that facility who knows how to do that really critical thing. And so when you invest in workforce upskilling, when you try to disseminate tribal knowledge, write stuff down, you increase your bus factor. You increase the number of people that if they retire today, how many people would have to retire today for your factory to no longer know how to make one of your things? Like, increasing that bus factor is critical for the resilience of your business, of your team. So
that is really an interesting concept. So I've just got to interject really quickly. Now, is this something, the bus factor? Because I am probably going to steal this for later content. I'm not going to lie here. The bus factor, is that something that you came up with? Or is that like a thing that I'm just now hearing about and I'm today's years
it's old? It's got to be a thing. I heard about it from a software engineer on our team. I think it's got to be like a popular term or something.
Thing.
I learned about it. I use it all the time now after learning about it.
Because you're not wrong, and it's a really good way to make that scenario real.
Yeah.
Hey, if something happened today and I was down two people, which stuff happens every day, especially on the floor, especially in a plant. I'm down two people. How much trouble am I in business-wise?
Yep. It's just business resilience. It's people, when people throw a bunch of complicated words and phrases at stuff, it like really murky, it like muddies the water about how to think about what matters to your company. Like at the end of the day, what you care about is being around tomorrow. And if you lose one person and your facility no longer has the ability to operate because that one person is no longer there, you're in trouble. And that is like one of the greatest threats to American manufacturing facilities, is that super low bus factor on tribal knowledge. That's the best, most succinct way to talk about what we have, right? We have a lot of folks who are retiring, who have a lot of tribal knowledge. We have generally some folks, there are younger folks coming into manufacturing. There are people being hired, not nearly enough, right? Like we have millions of unfilled manufacturing jobs. I would say if we like want to make sure that this 1-2 punch of folks retiring and taking that tribal knowledge with them doesn't end up like basically completely eroding our industrial base, like we need to increase the bus factor.
Yeah.
And the way we do that is through, I guess, my last suggestion idea, which is we need to make manufacturing cool and exciting and fun and sexy again. This is there with the cultural stigma that we have, or that we've had around blue collar jobs, around working in manufacturing being something that's like less interesting or less cool than being like a lawyer or a doctor. The best thing we can do as a society and as a company, if you're a manufacturing facility, you investing a little bit in some marketing, some branding around, like bring some like youthful energy to your presence, goes a long way. Like I, just because I'm a young guy and I'm saying this stuff, like getting on Twitter is like making things fun, making things cool, making it not super esoteric and disconnected from like the modern youth.
Or
like,
so serious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the like Gen Z, Gen Alpha people, like these kids are the future. You got to find a way to talk to them. You got to find a way to speak to them. You can't just look at them and think, ah, they're cringe and annoying. I don't want to interact with any Gen Zs or Gen Alphas. Those dumb kids don't know a thing. Dude, those are your future. And you got to figure out how to bridge that gap. And it's not up to them. It's up to you. You know, like it's, I get it. You're 55, you're 60. You think the dumb kids coming in the door, like they're lame and I don't want to talk to them. I don't want to.
And you're tired and you've got a job to do.
Yeah. But like, it's, you're the adult in the room and it's your job to reach out. It's your job to make sure that you are this sort of this parental figure shepherding these new entrants into the arena into feeling like your industry and your company is something to be excited about, that there's something fun here, something cool here, something meaningful. And I think the onus of that has been lost on a lot of folks. Like they look at their manufacturing roles as like clock in, clock out, and not as something that's like something to be proud of or excited about. And I think taking more like pride, I know a lot of folks do take a lot of pride in their work, but being more externally proud about it, doing social media stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that, I don't know. To me, I think a lot of folks get, you have like people on Twitter, on Instagram, like nonstop. It's like Gen Z, Gen Alpha. They're like, their brains are rotting from how much they're on social media. But like post pictures of your tractors, post pictures of your manufacturing, of your facilities. Like those things are cool.
Yep.
And like people love that stuff. And that's why I always encourage folks in manufacturing facilities to take more photos of their equipment, to show cool process. Be like, take a video. You know, a lot of folks are like, oh, this is like our proprietary stuff. We don't want to take a photo of it. Okay, man. Fine, I guess. Take photos.
Find something you can take a photo of. There's a whole facility there. Sorry, I run into this all the time because I'm always like, oh, like when I'm going on a plant tour, I'm like, oh, can I take pictures? Can I take video? That kind of thing. And it's the same thing. Oh, we have proprietary stuff. We're under an NDA. We can't talk about this. Okay. So tell me, what can I talk about? There's got to be something in this building that we can take pictures of. We can share, we can hype up on social media.
Exactly. You can't be too proud to show off what you're proud of. That's the thing I push people to be proud and externally proud. It's not useful for anybody if you're keeping your secrets all locked up away and there isn't a line of people waiting to learn them, right? People don't know what they don't know. And, that's right. And I think it's lost on a lot of people.
I love that so much, Phil. I really appreciate this entire conversation. I can't wait to share your story with everyone. For those that are listening in today, what is a good point of contact for you? So maybe they're listening, they want to follow up, they want to learn more. Where can they go to reach you?
So I'm pretty easily reachable over email. If you want to shoot, you can go to our website. Our website is diracinc.com. So diracinc.com. And my email is FIL. My name's Philip, so Phil with an F. FIL at diracinc.com. So super easy to reach over email. I live in my inbox. So please reach out. We're automating assembly work instructions. If you're a manufacturer, work instructions are a huge pain. Please reach out. We love working with folks. We love doing on-sites. We love doing case studies too. We actually just released a really cool one with a company called Ankra. Ankra is a tier one supplier to a bunch of really exciting aerospace and defense manufacturers. Just did a really cool case study that's live on our website about that. Took some cool photos. Got a really cool case study up on our website about that. Yeah, reach out. We'd love to visit your facility. I even love just visiting facilities, even out of fun, even if you're not a customer. Always love seeing new stuff. Let me know. Reach out.
Awesome. Very cool, Phil. I'm going to make sure to link all of that information in the show notes as well. So if you're listening, you can find all of Phil's information, contact information in the show notes today. But thank you again, Phil. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you to everyone listening today. We really appreciate you, and we will see you next time on Workforce 4.0.
Thanks for having me.